book and it invites you to fall in.
I literally asked them, I want to be a war reporter. Do you need any help in Bosnia?
The pilgrims, hey, I think I know the story, but you know, what really happened? And then the more I get into it, I go, whoa, I had no idea.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Today, Nathaniel Philbrick talks about his new book, Bunker Hill.
I am not a professional historian. You know, I am writing for a general audience. And, you know, I write these books out of, you know, a personal quest. I'm just curious about America. How were we back then? And, you know, and how did we get to where we are now?
Philbrick is a best-selling author, National Book Award winner, renowned scholar of American history, and a champion sailor. Coming up, Philbrick talks about the Boston Battle that ignited the American Revolution. Our guest interviewer this hour is Rich Folley, the founder of Bibliostar.tv. Philbrick begins by explaining how he wants to write history books that don't read like textbooks.
You know, I began life as a sailing journalist, and, you know, so I was always interested in character and story. And I guess what I'm trying to do is figure out how life, what it felt like to be alive in the past. And dusty dates have never made it for me. It doesn't happen. But if you can get a sense of how it smelled, you know, those little details that, you know, I don't know, for example, if in the middle of a battle, I at one point in this book cut to the fact that a guy who's going over the redoubt, you know, but musket balls going on either side of him, had been planted a garden on Boston Common, and he had just was delighted in the peas the day before. And, you know, those kinds of things for me, you know, these are people who, you know, even in extraordinary situations, were ordinary people, a lot like us, just in a different time. And so it's those details for me make it an emotional thing rather than an intellectual connection to the past.
Another big character in this book is obviously Boston. I mean, no one could read Bunker Hill and not kind of come out of it with sort of this appreciation of Boston as this gritty, tough city. And as I was reading this book, the Boston Marathon attacks happened,
Yeah. Reinforcing
once again that Boston is a gritty, tough city. Can you talk about just the historical precedence of that toughness and where it comes from?
Yeah, I mean, the Boston... We think of it as the cradle of liberty, and it was that. But the streets of Boston during the Revolution and in the years prior to the Revolution, were a very tough place. For example, one of the great holidays in Boston was celebrated on November 5th. Now, it was a version of Guy Fawkes Day, which is celebrated in England to celebrate the foiling of the plot to blow up Parliament and the King. And that's what they were celebrating in England. In Boston, it was a little different. Boston at this time was an island. No resemblance to what Boston is today. It was a 1.2 square mile island, dominated by three hills, very mountainous hills, and with a little town of 15,000 people packed into this community, divided into the North End, which still exists as an independent community, and the South End, which is now dominated by high-rises and things like that, but back then was the pricier side of town. And instead of Guy Fawkes Day, they called it Pope Night. And this meant it was basically an anti-Catholic fun fest where a gang from the North End would have its own cart on which would be a caricature of the devil beside a caricature of the Pope. The South End would have their cart with the Pope and the devil. And what they would do that night would be a bare-knuckled fight to steal the other side's cart. And countless broken bones. One year, a little kid was... His head was run over by one of the carts in the melee. Everybody just kept on going. But this was the kind of almost tribal, very brutal kind of thing that was going on in Boston. And this was a part of what was going on. And so that as tensions began to build that would eventually climax with the Revolution, this was the kind of traditions that they were coming out of, and that would dovetail into that wonderful American tradition of tar and feathering. And this was something that Bostonians could truly embrace.
Yeah, tar and feathering. When you're a kid and you hear about tarring and feathering, you see like chicken feathers or something, and it's almost comical.
Yeah.
The way you describe tarring and feathering in here sounds absolutely brutal. I mean, can you talk a little bit about the process of tarring and feathering?
Yeah. Well, these are the kinds of details I enjoy, particularly if they involve suffering and dehydration, starvation. Well, this time I had tar and feathering, so I was really excited, and I decided to make it the centerpiece of chapter one, where, you know, we all know about the Tea Party, but what most of us haven't heard about was about a month later, in January of 1774, as you know, people are wondering, how is England going to respond to the Tea Party? And the Patriot leaders are trying to keep the lid on. You know, let's just avoid some of this violence until we find out what's happening. But there was a customs inspector named John Malcolm, who was a Bostonian with an attitude. He was not a pleasant man, and he was a loyalist because of the fact that he was associated with the customs service. And so the Patriots despised this kind of guy anyway, and this guy just invited conflict. And one night, in January of 1774, coldest night of the winter, Boston Harbor had frozen over solid. Malcolm gets into an argument with a patriot. Blows are exchanged. Soon his house is surrounded by a crowd of hundreds of outraged citizens of Boston. Eventually, he's dragged from his residence, thrown into a cart, and lugged up to the center of town where the Boston Massacre occurred, where they strip his clothes off, and by this time they've got a good bonfire going where they're heating pine tar, tar into this black, very hot liquid, which they pour onto his naked flesh, and which would have effectively parboiled.
It doesn't kill you, though.
It doesn't kill you, but it really hurts. And Malcolm was a tough guy, and so he was taking it, but now they take a pillow and take the down and smear it all over him. And then he would endure for the next 5 hours, be dragged around the streets of Boston, beaten periodically, made to disavow all associations with the royal governor, and eventually rolled out of the cart into his house, where he would be remained, he would live, but beaten to the edge of life. 6 weeks later, he would finally venture from his bed, but by this time, the flesh had come off his back in what were described as stakes. And, you know, this was just another day in Boston. And it, just as a side note, word of this got back to Parliament as they were discussing what to do about the Tea Party. And they said, whoa, this is what they're doing after the Tea Party. We're really going to put the clamps down.
Yeah, the idea of democratic ideals and a fair and you know, democratic America wasn't exactly on display at all times in Boston. In fact, reading this book, you recognize that if you were a loyalist or were even thought to be potentially a loyalist, that you were in danger in Boston and that the mob could turn on you at any time. And it just strikes me as an entirely un-American sort of way of life, frankly.
Yeah,
it was kind of dominating the city at that time.
Well, you know, it's a surprise. I think all of us look to our revolution and like to think of how nonviolent it was, and essentially it's true. I mean, compared to what the French Revolution and many revolutions since, it was relatively nonviolent. But I think kind of written out of our own revolution is the fact that it wasn't pretty, and it was a civil war. It was families getting torn apart. John Malcolm's younger brother, Daniel, had been a foremost patriot and was buried a few years before the incident with the tar and feathering of his older brother in Copse Hill Cemetery in the North End you can still see his gravestone, and it says he was a patriot. But community and families were torn apart by this. And the patriots made it work by intimidating many of those that were undecided. And that's the thing. It wasn't just you were a patriot and then you were opposing the British. there were three different groups. There were those that would eventually become revolutionaries, which I call patriots in the book. There were the loyalists who treasured their relationship with England. Many of them were merchants, and that's where, you know, all of their trade was directed. And then there were most people who were undecided and really didn't want any of this to happen, wanted things to stay the way they had always been. But as one event led to the other, it became clear you had to make a choice. And the many of the patriot leaders and the made it worth your while to go with their side.
Well, the merchants were one of those people where they needed the money. They wanted those imports coming in. They didn't want to have the ports shut down. Almost didn't matter if they were patriots or loyalists. There was, you know, their livelihood on the line, and they were even sort of muscled out of the picture too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and what you see is, you know, there were ideological issues of representation and taxation. We're definitely there. But so much of what side people ended up had to do with who they were related to, had been their family enemies before all of this happened. You know, it's and then all of this begins to kick in, and people get more and more polarized, and off it goes. And so, you know, there is a complexity to it that I think it's important to realize. It wasn't, you know, as noble a thing as we would like. It was very much like life is as we experience today. No one knows where it's headed. You know, no one's talking about independence at this point. That's the last thing anybody wants to happen. Even the revolutionaries aren't, they don't want an independent country. What they want is to go back to the way it had been when England wasn't trying to tax them. And they wanted, it was kind of conservative, really. But it would all change as events led towards what would become the Declaration of Independence, yeah.
Another thing I love about your book's period is sort of Philbrickian, I guess, is this idea of the unexpected hero, the person you didn't know about, that's not in the history books. There's a lot in this book about, obviously, Samuel Adams and John Hancock, and we'll talk about all those people tonight, Paul Revere and all those people that we've all learned about in school. But there are characters in this book that I knew nothing about, never even heard the names before. I mean, when you go into writing a book, do you know that you're going to sort of angle towards those people, or do they just present themselves to you?
You know, it's a little combination of both. I you know, every book I write is because I'm curious about the topic. You know, often the pilgrims, hey, I think I know the story, but, you know, what really happened? And then the more I get into it, I go, whoa, I had no idea. And characters present themselves that I had no idea that, you know, they would become major players. And this happened with this book, although I have to say the sort of the leading unknown character is a 33-year-old doctor named Joseph Warren, who, while all the patriot leaders that we usually associate with Boston were away at the Continental Congress, it was this 33-year-old doctor who became kind of the de facto leader of the on-the-ground revolution. And he was the guy who gave Paul Revere, who we've all heard of, the order to alert the countryside that the British were headed to Concord. But who had ever heard of Joseph Warren? And the last patriot leader in Boston on April 18th before Lexington and Concord. And so, and you know, this was a guy that was just amazing. There's a swashbuckling aspect to him. You know, Errol Flynn would be great, you know, as Joseph Warren. And he was the kind of guy who would walk into a room of people who were deeply divided, talk to both sides, and eventually everyone would agree with him just because of the power of his eloquence. He was tremendously eloquent. But as a doctor, he was kind of uniquely situated. He knew everyone in the city. And in a community of 15,000, which I know from Nantucket, that's about the year-round population of Nantucket, and if you don't necessarily know everybody, but you pretty much recognize them. And Warren, as a doctor, was, you know, his patients ranged from prostitutes to the gentry of the town. He, you know, he had connections that went through all the social classes. And so as this built towards a revolution, he was just perfectly positioned and had the temperament to really make things happen.
Yeah, the book opens with sort of a discussion about that character. I don't know if I'm giving anything away by talking about what happens to him. I'm assuming
spoiler
not.
Alert, yeah.
Spoiler alert, he dies. But the idea of the beginning with John Quincy Adams overlooking sort of the battle of Bunker Hill with his mother Abigail is a really powerful way to start the book. And I understand that you actually stood in that spot and actually looked down. What does it look like today?
Yeah, if you go where the John Adams was born and raised and where his son was born and raised, it was called Braintree. It's now Quincy. The old homestead is still there. You can visit it. It's a very humble cat slide of a roof, colonial building. But there's a hill not far away, and one of the park rangers who was involved in the Adams site took myself and a friend up to this hill, and you look out and you can see Boston Harbor. And one of the things I struggle with when I'm writing a book is coming up with a preface. I will write 85, literally 85 versions of a way into the book before I find the way I want to use. It's almost an unconscious thing. I'm trying to find an event that speaks to what the book is about, and yet I don't even really know what the book is going to be about. And so I will follow every possible scene, write it out, and it's finally when I go, yeah, whoa, that one 8 drafts before, that's the one. And in this one, it is a 7-year-old John Quincy Adams with his mother Abigail, who was then 31, standing on this hill very near their house during the Battle of Bunker Hill, which was fought on the Charlestown Peninsula about 10 miles away from their house. They could see it from where they were, and it was surrounded by British warships that were firing on the newly constructed Patriot Redoubt or earthen fort atop the hill. And Quincy, John Quincy Adams, remembered many years later, in his late 70s, by this time he had been president of the United States. He was now in a much more humble capacity as a U.S. representative, leading the fight for against slavery. And what he remembered was the terror that he and his mother felt. His father was away at the Continental Congress, and the sorrow when they learned that his doctor, Joseph Warren, who had set his fractured forefinger on his right hand just a short time before, had died on the third and last British charge of that battle. And it so moved John Quincy Adams that he refused to attend all future celebrations of the Battle of Bunker Hill, and there were many of them. And for me, this was it. This was my way in, because I wanted to talk about, there was this unknown guy, and why was he unknown? Well, he died, and while all the patriots we associate with Boston were away, and this scene made that happen in a way, because if anyone who has raised children or been a child knows that what you see when you're 7 years old, particularly if it's traumatic, it never leaves you.
Well, if you have a reputation for anything, it's for meticulous detail, the sort of unknown tidbits. That process, I can only imagine the war room that is your office, and you're getting stuff coming at you about every bit of this book and probably books that you haven't yet written all at once. What is that process of disseminating? It's got to be more organized than my Post-its. I mean, what is it that you're doing?
Oh, no, you're much more organized than I am.
How does it work? I mean, where do you put it all? How do you keep it organized?
I drive my wife crazy. I work in the basement because that's the only place that anyone could tolerate what I create. I call it the bunker. It's in the basement. And unfortunately, to get out to our workout place, you have to go through there. And it's just, it's often a rat's warren. But for this book, for example, I get the books. So I have hundreds, if not more than 1,000 books crowded around me in a very confined space. And for this book, recreating what Boston was like was absolutely essential. And fortunately, because the British were there for 2 years, basically, and and did very detailed maps of the city. We have a great record of a visual record, historic maps of Boston in this period. And the Boston Public Library has a wonderful map collection, the Leventhal collection. And you can go online, pick the map you want, order it up, and they'll print you a copy of varying sizes. And I went with poster size for about every historic map I could get. Like instead of Jim Morrison, I'm looking at historic Boston. And I put them on a poster board and surrounded myself with all of these and had a felt tip pen, and I'd mark where Joseph Warren lived here, Paul Revere lived here, John Adams was here, there was the Green Dragon Tavern, all these kinds of things. And for me, it was absolutely essential. It was where I began to get a sense of this community, you know, and even the topography you could begin to see, and the flow of, you know, anyone who's driven in Boston knows we are still paying the price for the settlement pattern of the colonial and revolutionary period, you know, where a cow going down, drunkenly down a hill became a cart path, which became a road. And so, you know, that's what I was trying to sort of channel. And, you know, there were 50 wharves along the eastern edge of the harbor and all those kinds of things. And so for me, my office is this, you know, collection of things. And then I go through, I mean, my research process is a year of reading stuff, creating a bibliography and getting a rough sense of chapters. And then after about a year of all of this, of furious note-taking, I then begin to work chapter by chapter, which means I then research all over again specifically for a chapter, because I cannot retain everything I need to know in a book all at once. I'm sure there's someone who can. I can't. I only have a general sense of where I'm going. So I then get to the point where I feel I can start, and it's after the preface. I start the first chapter. Typically, it's 3 or 4 weeks of reading the stuff that I need to do. I even often might have to go to an archive to get something I didn't anticipate getting. Get those notes together. This is, would be typically for a chapter, 150 pages of notes typed out. And then I spend about a week reading the notes, internalizing them, taking notes on the notes. And I wish I knew to do this in college. I would have done a lot better.
Yeah.
But so I get to the point, and you know, and every day of this process, it's just becoming more and more in my head. And then finally, I'm to the point where it's okay. I've got an outline of the chapter, and then I start to write. And then it's kind of like painting a room, you know, where the prep is 9/10 of it, and then the actual painting goes quite quickly. For me, it's then is I start writing, and depending on how quickly it's going, it'll be 10 hours of a day just trying to get it on paper. And, you know, it takes about a week to get that chapter done. And then, my poor wife, and then I find reading it is very important. It's just a whole different side of the brain. So I have a first draft that I, after dinner, I read to my wife while she does the dishes. She's a lawyer and is not afraid of criticism.
Best kind of critic.
Yeah, it's critical. She has a notepad beside the sink and a pen, and I'm reading, she'll take up the pen and start going. I go, what? What was wrong with that? And she'll say, just keep going. Just keep going. And so it just goes like that. You know, I'm going, what? What? You know, and so I get to the end, or then I go, and I'm reading it, and I go, oh, this is awful. I'm just, okay, just don't, we'll skip to this. I'll come back. Anyways, and so I get through that, and then after she's done with the dishes, she sits down and goes through her list. And it's a great way to spend an evening. But for me, it's like, wow, it's okay. So I've just gotten outside of myself and sort of looked at this thing that I've been working on furiously for a month. and gotten some perspective on it. And so the next morning, I will return to the manuscript, furiously rewrite it with Melissa's input and a lot of my own problems that I try to put in there. And then a few days after that, I send it to my parents, who are still with us. My father's a retired English professor. He's the dissertation advisor I never had. And he's equally tough. And he really goes for grammar and things like that. But it's my mother. Oh, my gosh, my mother.
No nurturing. Good
no.
Job, son.
Oh, no. But she's great because she is, in many ways, my ideal reader. You know, she was a kindergarten teacher who's always read constantly. And history is not necessarily her first interest, but she reads these with, she's willing to read these. And so with that input, I do a final, it's not a final draft, but it's a draft with which I then, okay, now I'm ready to do the next chapter. And then on it goes.
I understand the hunger to know, like, as soon as you can, like, right away. And it struck me as sort of interesting as I was reading through this book about how slow information actually moved in the 1700s, however. Like, maybe not so much in the colonies where, like, tavern to tavern, things were sort of spreading like wildfire. But to get information back to Great Britain and back, there's a scene in the book where Josiah Quincy is on a boat coming back and has some really important news to tell Samuel Adams and others, and he had talked to Ben Franklin, and he really had to get there, and it took months, and he ended up, I think he was dead before he landed.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about just the difficulty in communicating back to Great Britain at the time and the slowness of communication, or so it seems?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that for me was, you know, I knew that we didn't have the internet then. You know, we didn't have cell phones.
But it'd been nice with YouTube
right.
or something.
But you know, one of the reasons why the revolution became an almost an inevitability was the communication gap, just what you've described. And you know, my main character in Bunker Hill is Boston, but another very important supporting character is the Atlantic Ocean. 3,000 miles of ocean between England and Boston. It took about a month to get a letter from Boston to London, and because you're going with the breezes, and a month is not a short time, and you know things are happening quickly. No, you send a letter, and off it goes. It gets to England, and it takes probably another month for Parliament, the King, to coordinate a response, and then you have to go against the winds back to America. So it can take 2 months. And, you know, by the time you come, poor General Gage, who's the royal governor of Boston at this time, of Massachusetts at this time, you know, by the time he got a directive from England, it was always too late. And so, you know, this kind of thing was an essential part of why once relations were going bad, it wasn't going to get better. It was going to go from bad to worse. And, you know, for example, word of Lexington and Concord. General Gage is very quick at getting his account onto a vessel called the Suki that heads out from Boston for London. You know, we got to get it to the first. So, but the Patriots realize, okay, people aren't going to really believe our side unless we do a good job of spinning this. So what the Patriot leaders did quite wisely was to interview people who had been there, including captured British soldiers. And they had actual transcripts that were taken in the days after Lexington and Concord, often feverishly fast because they need to get this done. And so they assembled an account of Lexington and Concord that was from a Patriot perspective. And they did this in record time, within 3 or 4 days. And Joseph Warren was, by this point, president of the Provincial Congress, and was spurring them on, come on, we need this. And so by just a few days later, they had it ready. So they decide, we got to go with a fast vessel. And this is where I like sailboats. So, you know, you have to get a sailboat race in every book I write. And so they went, they didn't go for a large vessel. They went for a schooner, the Quero, out of Salem. And they realized, let's not load it with goods. Let's make this a fast voyage. So they used ballast stones to position it so the vessel was in its optimal trim. And off it goes with a bare-bones crew as fast as they can across the Atlantic. They would not only pass the Suki, and there's no record of them going, ha, 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 ha. You know, they didn't see each other. But they would not only pass the Suki that had gone 4 or 5 days ahead of them, they would put almost 2 weeks between them. And so the captain from Salem arrives in London with this printed transcript, the account of what happens. And they called him the accidental captain because no one could, what? How did you get here? What's going on? And unfortunately, people, loyalists in London who knew this captain and knew he was a very honest person said, I'm afraid this may be more truthful than we like. And it drove the British ministry crazy because for 2 weeks they couldn't respond because they didn't have Gage's account. And so all of England knew the Patriot account, and that became the received wisdom. And Gage's account limps in 2 weeks later. It's different, but not all that different. And so in this very critical war of spin, the Patriots won the first round.
Gage is a fascinating character. Gage was, you know, sort of in a no-win situation. He comes off as very sympathetic in your book. I know in your notes you mentioned that not everyone feels that way about him, but can you talk a little bit about what a difficult position he was in here in the United States?
Yeah. No, I ended up having a lot of sympathy for Thomas Gage. He was a very decent man who had done a very good job of being the military commander of North America for more than a decade. He was married to a beautiful woman from the New Jersey area and hadn't been back to England for any significant time for 19 years. He had come over for the French and Indian War, been there with Washington at the onset of the war with Braddock's defeat. And so this guy was, you know, had a certain sense of sympathy for America. But he was in England when word of the Tea Party arrived. And King George and the Prime Minister looked to him as an expert in colonial affairs. And he said, well, you know, if we can cap Boston, if we can get some soldiers there, we should be able to, through kind of shock and awe, put a lid on this. And it was obviously a miscalculation. But, you know, he had a shot when it came to just the Boston Port Act, which was the British response, which was overbearing. They shut down Boston as a commercial port, meaning any vessel with goods had to go to Plymouth to the south or Salem to the north and then come in over land, which, you know, just really was basically made it impossible to make a living in Boston. And there were a lot of people who were saying, well, let's just pay for the tea. Benjamin Franklin had proposed this in London. And there was a movement to sort of do that. And Gage was trying to work that angle. But then Parliament really kind of pulled the rug out from underneath him when they also passed the Massachusetts Government Act, which robbed not only Boston, but all of Massachusetts of its royal charter. And the town meeting that was the lifeblood of the Patriot movement and the identity of New England, where people decided things by consensus. You know, it was really kind of a democratic process that was unlike really anywhere else in the colonies and England. Those were declared illegal. This created a firestorm around Boston. And suddenly, Gage realized it's not just getting a lid on Boston. Now the entire colony of Massachusetts, all 250 towns. And this was when Massachusetts included modern Maine. And all of these towns were inflamed with how dare they do this. And these towns all had militia, a tradition that went back more than a century, where each town had a history of defending itself from attack from the French and Indians. They were farmers and artisans that had muskets that trained on a fairly regular basis. And if they felt their liberties were going to be violated, they made it clear that they were willing to fight.
You're listening to IPR News Radio. Coming up, Nathaniel Philbrick will tell us the real story about the Battle of Bunker Hill. That's all in Part 2, right here on Interlochen Public Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6!
You're listening to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We come back to the conversation with Nathaniel Philbrick, author of Bunker Hill and other books on American history.
Yeah, you get a sense for the beginning of the sort of gun ownership feelings back then. You know, everybody was, and the fact that one of the big problems they had was gunpowder and making sure that they had access to gunpowder. And you know, I was rooting for them to get gunpowder. And yet at the same time, I'm not so sure about guns today. Yet I certainly wanted those guys to have some guns. You know.
Yeah, I mean, this is the tradition America comes from. Was, you know, you don't get yourself into through a revolution by simply saying liberty for all. You need a military to make regime change.
Yeah.
And New England was unlike Ireland and Scotland, where England had very recently subdued revolts. England had successfully squashed every rebellion it had ever encountered in the British Empire up until this point. But this was a place with a different... This was a populace that was armed. And you mentioned gunpowder, which would become the valuable commodity in New England, because there was nowhere in the colonies where they could effectively manufacture gunpowder. It all came from England. And so as things became more and more tense, and it looked like violence might actually break out, everyone realized that England would shut down shipments of gunpowder to the colonies, and so all that they would have is what they had already had in their town magazines and their powder houses. And so it became this race to collect gunpowder, and General Gage would become part of that. And so you see all throughout Massachusetts people racing for gunpowder, accumulating it jealously. And, you know, poor Gage. He is the governor trying to subdue these people, but he doesn't have martial law. So, and he respects the English liberties of the Patriots. The Patriots do not have that sense of English liberties when it comes to the Loyalists and the British soldiers. They are running circles around the law, smuggling out weapons from Boston, smuggling out gunpowder. At one point, and this is great, you know, it's fall of 74, and it's beginning to look like this could go really bad, and the Patriots in Boston have the audacity to try to smuggle some cannons out of Boston, and at night they form a kind of raft, and they float some old cannons over the mill pond, which used to exist on the northern part of Boston. You know, there's a Causeway Street in Boston. That's where the mill dam used to be. And they float it out, but the tide goes down, and they get trapped. The next morning, the Patriots are gone, but there's this raft with a cannon on it. So Gage and the Admiral Graves confiscate the cannon, right? You know, this seems right. Well, the owner of the cannon takes them to court. And Gage is going, what? And so it's now out of his hands. It goes to the royal court, and guess what? They decide in favor of the cannon owner. The British military have to return the cannon. And Gage is going, what? You know, how can I do this? And so I think it's unappreciated fact that one of the reasons why the Patriots of Boston could so effectively launch a revolution was what that the occupying army, and the, at least the leader of it, basically respected their ability, you know, their liberties. And yet they were fighting against British tyranny.
Well, the whole book, I was you had me sort of really going down this Boston path, and I was there. And then there's a point in the book, some point, where George Washington comes in and makes this sort of end of the book cameo, and you start to hear about this. And it was all of a sudden it reminded me that there's these 12 other colonies, and there's this entire more perhaps more genteel place that's happening in the United States. What did the other colonies think about what Boston was pulling us towards as we went there?
Yeah, it's very interesting. The First Continental Congress in Philadelphia, this was in the fall of 1774, and what Samuel Adams and John Adams quickly realized is there was great distrust of New England. There was a real fear among the colonies, Pennsylvania, New York, and to the south, that New England, which had a warrior reputation ever since King Philip's War, which was fought, which is the kind of the conclusion of Mayflower, my earlier book, was fought exactly 100 years before the American Revolution broke out. Brutal conflict. Ever since then, there had been a series of French and Indian wars, and New England had always contributed to those wars, and its people had a fighting reputation. And the fear was that if violence should break out, that England, and this is stated in a Samuel Adams letter, the fear was that New England would defeat the British and then go after the rest of the colonies, and it would become a New England dictatorship. This was a fear shared by many throughout. And so Samuel Adams and John Adams quickly realized, whoa, we've got to work this. We've got to assure people that this is not what we're about. And so they seem to have had a very direct role in naming George Washington as a Virginian, as the head of the Continental Army, to allay these kinds of concerns. And yet, when Washington arrives, Joseph Warren dies at Bunker Hill. He has been the spiritual and effective leader of the Patriot movement. Huge power vacuum. 10 days later, Washington arrives. Thank goodness it was Washington, because I don't think there's anyone who would have had the patience, the charisma, and just the personal force to deal with what Washington... He came up there, and there's thousands of New England militiamen. They're dirty, and he is completely depressed and even frightened by what he sees. When you read his letters, he describes them as nasty and dirty, and that their officers are no better than their men. He came from a very hierarchical society in Virginia, not the case in New England, where because of their upbringing in town meetings, soldiers in the provincial army, when told what to do by an officer, would say, wait a minute, we need to discuss this before we do that. And so the officer would go, okay, and then they talk about, okay, we'll do that. And so this was how decisions were made, and they would only serve with people from their own town, people they knew, family members, friends, and it was this tribal sense of identity. And so Washington appears and goes, I'm supposed to make an army out of these people? And Washington would make many missteps in that first year. Everyone would, but he kept at it. And I think it's kind of an unorthodox way to say this is where America began. But remember I told you about Pope's Night, that wonderful New England tradition in Boston? On November 5th, 1775, Washington has been the commander of what will become the Continental Army for a few months, and he learns from his officers that they want to celebrate Pope Night and this anti-Catholic celebration. And he says, wait a minute, do you realize we're trying to get Catholic French Canada to come in on our side in this revolution? Do you realize that it would be helpful to have the French on our side that are Catholics? What are you thinking? And so he would write this resolution, this regulation for the army, in which he outlaws Pope Night. saying he calls it a foolish holiday. And I'm paraphrasing here, but he cannot believe officers in his army would propose such a, you know, terrible thing. What he's doing is he's getting the people of New England to think outside the mentality that has controlled them ever since the Puritans arrived in 1630. He's making a portion of the 13 colonies that begin to think of themselves not as from Massachusetts or New Hampshire or wherever, but from America. And I think really with that, Washington set the tone that would lay the groundwork for what would become a new nation.
That's that reminds me of the section in the book that I think we talked about a little bit earlier, but that so many of these people weren't necessarily fighting for equality or liberty or democracy necessarily. In fact, there were slaves, there were, you know, Catholics and Protestants. There, you know, there's obviously, if you looked like them and believed like them and had the same beliefs, then you were in. But anybody else was on the outside of that looking in. It really was a different sort of thinking at the time.
Yeah, I mean, we like to look to our revolution as they were going for democratic ideals. But when you look at it, I mean, what they were democratic ideals as long as you were white male and a property owner. And, you know, fighting side by side on the Lexington Green on April 19th were several slaves who the black poet Phyllis Wheatley, who was a resident of Boston at this time, made it clear that there was a certain paradox for the patriots complaining of British slavery when they, in fact, were slave owners. They weren't creating 21st century America. They were creating it wasn't an English society. And, you know, you can look to those town meetings as a kind of embryonic version of what would become the democratic ideals that we so treasure. But they weren't looking at personal liberties, at including people outside of those who were just like them.
You know, Jill mentioned earlier that I worked at C-SPAN. We used to have gatherings of Lincoln historians, and they were incredibly passionate people, and they had very strong opinions, and some of the spirited debates, I mean, more than spirited, I mean, sometimes they get downright angry. I can only imagine that Boston historians, this could be slugfests. I mean, you know, this thing could get ugly when we're talking about Boston, but what is your relationship with other historians, and how do they respond to some of your work, and is there ever any challenges, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, well, you know, I am not a professional historian. I was an English major in college, learned my history in the trenches, you know, going to the archives and writing my first book about Nantucket, and have, you know, been widening the focus ever since. And, you know, and I am writing, I am a nonfiction writer who writes about history. And I'm narrative history. And academic historians are absolutely essential to my process. Those are the books that I depend on for, you know, the kinds of analysis that hopefully make my book something different from kind of a regurgitation of what we want to hear about our past. And yet I am not writing for tenure. You know, I am writing for a general audience. I am trying to share my personal interest in history, curiosity, with others. And, you know, I write these books out of, you know, a personal quest. I'm just curious about America. How were we back then? And, you know, and how did we get to where we are now? And so, you know, there are professors that have been hugely helpful to me. William Fowler, who is a professor at Northeastern and the former editor of the New England Quarterly, he published my first attempts at history, academic articles about Nantucket and merit and things related to that in the New England Quarterly. And he has also written a ton of books on about this period, and he has been very helpful to me, you know, read this manuscript and you know, knows Boston better than anyone. And others like that have been helpful. But you know, I do not operate in a university setting, and you know, and I think that's part of who I am. And but that said, the university setting has created so much of the perspective and insights that you know, I rely on in trying to tell the stories I tell.
You know, Bunker Hill, the title is Bunker Hill, the battle is Bunker Hill, but it actually took place on a different hill. It took place on Breed's Hill, and I didn't know this when I was growing up. I don't think it actually matters to me now. It's still Bunker Hill to me, but actually if you go to Bunker Hill, the Bunker Hill Memorial, it's actually... There's Breed's Hill, too, and can you just talk about the confusion that's come up with it?
This is one of the most confusing battles on the planet, and it probably, mainly because it began in confusion. The orders were for William Prescott to build an earthen fort on Bunker Hill, which is the highest hill on the Charlestown Peninsula, well to the north, away from Boston. But for reasons we're not sure of, on the night of June 1775, William Prescott went over Bunker Hill and then continued to march a half mile to the smaller Breed's Hill, which was right in the face of the British in Boston. And he built his redoubt there. The whole point of the fort was to hopefully delay on a British attack. Instead, he provoked what would become the bloodiest battle of the Revolution. And so the battle of the Bunker Hill was fought on Breed's Hill. And it began in confusion, would end in confusion. British maps would call it Bunker Hill, even though it was Breed's Hill. And Breed's Hill was not in common use at this time as a term. And so the Bunker Hill Monument would be built on Breed's Hill. So you go to the monument today, there it says Breed's Hill at the bottom of the Bunker Hill Monument. It's completely confusing. But, you know, hey, this is America.
You talked about Little Big Man, the movie, and your movie has been optioned. Ben Affleck's attached to it. What are your thoughts about one of your books hitting the big screen, potentially? I know the sort of pitfalls that can happen to these movies, but what are your thoughts about this actually making its way to a big theater?
It's intriguing. And, you know, I obviously am excited by the prospect. I think there's no director in Hollywood who knows Boston better than Ben Affleck. So I think he would, you know, I can't think of a better match for the material. And, you know, it's a different medium. You can't do a slideshow of a book and make it a good movie. And so, you know, I think it's important that it be what it is. That the screenwriter and the director and the, you know, all that, it's its own entity, and I will obviously be a very interested bystander, and will provide whatever input is requested. But yeah, no, I'm a huge fan of the movies. I spend so much time reading that to relax, I like to watch stupid TV and a lot of movies. And I'm perfectly fine on book tour spending a night by myself at a movie theater in a city. That's my idea of fun. And so for me, it'll be a very interesting thing to see how it works out.
Well, I hope it does. And I might even be able to get you to a movie tonight if we move along.
Okay, all right.
I will. One of the things, we're going to take questions in just a sec, but we talked earlier about maybe having you read a passage.
Yeah,
from the book, and why don't, after you read the passage, we'll turn the lights on and take some questions from the audience.
Okay. Well, I thought I would read. Well, thank you. I thought I would read from the end of Bunker Hill. It's not the epilogue, but it's how the last chapter ends, and this is after the evacuation of Boston, after cannons from Fort Ticonderoga are placed on Dorchester Heights, and the British are forced to leave. With the approach of the summer of 1776, Bostonians began to emerge from the dark doldrums of the siege. Howe's fleet of almost 150 vessels had sailed for Halifax at the end of March, but a few naval warships continued to linger near the Boston Lighthouse to warn supply ships arriving from Britain that the army had removed to Nova Scotia. On June 13, the last of the men of war was finally forced to depart when cannons were installed on one of the harbor's outlying islands. By the middle of July, word had reached the city of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. They were no longer fighting simply to preserve their ancient liberties. They were fighting to create a new nation. The officers of Washington's army had begun to talk in these terms as early as the fall of 1775, but not until the publication of Thomas Paine's Common Sense in January 1776 did the goal of independence begin to look like an inevitability. "We have it in our power to begin the world over again," Paine wrote. "A situation similar to the present hath not happened since the days of Noah until now. The birthday of a new world is at hand." On July 18, the Declaration of Independence was made public for the first time in Boston. As sheriff, William Greenleaf was supposed to read all official proclamations, but the 56-year-old Greenleaf had a weak voice. So he asked Thomas Crafts, the same man who had objected to the promotion of Henry Knox to colonel of the Army's artillery regiment, to act as his herald. A big man with a fiery red face, Crafts was now a colonel in Massachusetts artillery regiment, and he and Greenleaf stood together on the balcony of the townhouse. Ahead of them was not only a large crowd, but an unobstructed view of Long Wharf, where more than 2 years before General Gage and his regulars had first disembarked. Greenleaf read a passage from the Declaration. Crafts repeated the words in his own booming voice, and so it went. According to Abigail Adams, who was in the crowd that day, great attention was given to every word. As soon as Crafts had finished, the cry from the balcony was, Abigail wrote, "God save our American states," and then three cheers which rendered the air. The bells rang. The privateers fired, the forts and batteries, the cannon were discharged, the platoons followed, and every face appeared joyful. Later that evening, the ornate figures of the lion and the unicorn, representing England and Scotland, that bracketed the gable at the front of what Adams now called the State House, were taken down and burned in a bonfire, along with the King's Arms from the courthouse. Boston had survived. But every vestige of the king was destroyed that night. "Thus ends royal authority," Abigail wrote, "and all the people shall say, Amen."
Very nice. Very nice. I just want to thank you very much, and thank you, Philbrick, for being in Traverse City
today.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Really wonderful. Really appreciate it.
That was Nathaniel Philbrick at the National Writers Series with guest host Rich Folly. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of the new book Bunker Hill, as well as In the Heart of the Sea and Mayflower. On the next National Writers Series program, we hear from CIA veteran Jason Matthews. His debut novel is Red Sparrow. You can find out more about the National Writers Series at nationalwritersseries.org. Thanks to Joe Bears at the Traverse City Opera House. I'm Linnea Melcarrick, and this is Interlochen Public Radio.